Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Osher Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Joan Walsh, and I'm the editor-at-large of Salon.com. It is my distinct and honest and sincere pleasure to introduce Dr. Joseph Stiglitz. He's the author of The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. I just finished it. You must read it. Dr. Stiglitz is a professor at Columbia University, and he's a recipient of the 2001 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. He served in the Clinton administration as a member and chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and he was a chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. I tried to memorize this stuff. It didn't work. There's so much, and I'm going to say it all because it's really important. He was also one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. In 2008, Dr. Stiglitz chaired the commission reporting on the reasons for and the solutions to the financial crisis. It's now known as the Stiglitz Report. The Commission, also the Commission on the Measurement of Economic Performance and Social Progress, and the Commission of Experts on Reforms of the International Financial and Monetary Systems. But he doesn't talk in jargon like that. He created a new branch of economics called the Economics of Information, and he founded one of the leading economic journals, the Journal of Economic Perspectives. He's authored over 300 papers and 24 books, including the very important Globalization and Its Discontents. And that one's been translated into 35 languages and sold more than 1 million copies worldwide, globally. Last year, Foreign Policy magazine named him one of the top global thinkers. Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Joseph Stiglitz. I know, they're a little tight. We can adjust them. But they're great microphones. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I want to point out that even before Occupy Wall Street came up with what was really a brilliant slogan, "We are the 99%, you were the person who, to me, really framed the issue of the top 1% very well. You wrote a Vanity Fair article in May 2011 of the top one, of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%. And the thing that did for me, obviously playing on of the people, by the people, and for the people, it framed what had happened with wealth and with inequality not merely as a force of nature or globalization, you wrote the book on that, but as a political issue, the result of a set of series of political decisions that then reinforced that inequality. Can you talk a little bit about how you saw that happening?
Well, I think it's important to realize that as an economist, we always begin trying to interpret inequality as being determined by market forces.
Right.
But if you look around the world, you realize that America has more inequality than any of the other advanced industrial countries. And those market forces are at play in all those other countries. So
sure.
You have to ask the question, why are we different?
Right.
And a similar question, Americans like to think of our country as a land of opportunity. We all know people who made it from the bottom to the top or immigrants who made it. But for an economist, again, it's not the example, it's the statistics. What is the likelihood
right.
that somebody makes it from the bottom to the top? And again, the U.S. is the country of the least opportunity of any of the advanced industrial countries for which there's data. And that's really quite striking because it's so different from our image. You know, we used to think of ossified Europe, old Europe.
Sclerotic old Europe.
Exactly. And we've become a country with less opportunity, less mobility, less chance of somebody from the bottom making it than even ossified Europe.
Right.
So that leads you to ask the question, what is different about our economy and some of these other economies? And, of course, there are lots of factors that are different, but one of the things is market forces don't exist in a vacuum. We shape market forces. Our laws, our regulations shape those market forces. And that's where the politics come in.
Right.
Because the way we've shaped those market forces has shaped it to work for the benefit of those at the top. So, you know, just to give you one example, take our bankruptcy laws. You know, something that sounds very technical, arcane. Well, we have a bankruptcy law, and this is only in the last 12 years or so.
Right, we changed it.
Yeah, we changed it. So we have a bankruptcy law that gives first priority to derivatives, you know, the speculative securities that brought on AIG, and we had to bail it out for $150 billion. And if you give – first priority means that there's a problem, the derivatives, the speculators, get paid before anybody else,
any
before workers, before any other claimant. And, of course, if you do that, that encourages derivatives.
Right.
And it distorts the economy, and it leads to the kinds of activities that have a lot of inequality thriving.
Right, because they're protected.
Because they're protected. And then at the other extreme, again in our bankruptcy law, what we say is, and again, I think we're unique in this, students cannot discharge their debts even in bankruptcy.
Right.
Even if the school doesn't deliver on what's promised. You know, it's sort of like usually you buy a product and you say satisfaction guaranteed or your money back.
Right.
These for-profit schools say to our students, no matter, you know, satisfaction almost is guaranteed not to occur, and you'll never get that money back. It's going to be an albatross around your neck for the rest of your life.
And we also know that you can't discharge any part of your mortgage debt in bankruptcy. So these certain things protect certain sectors, obviously.
And they encourage, and it distorts the economy as it creates inequality. You know, another example of how our laws and regulations help create inequality, and you know there are many dimensions of inequality, both at the top and at the bottom. You look at the financial sector; they engaged in a lot of predatory lending, abusive credit card practices, and you ask, what does that do? Well, it moves money from the bottom to the top,
right?
And when that happens, the size of the pie doesn't get any bigger,
right?
But you get more wealth at the top and more people in poverty. So again, we could have stopped that. In fact, a lot of people tried to pass legislation to stop this, but the banks used all their lobbying power and stopped that. So that's, again, how politics has played out in creating America's unique style of inequality.
Right. I think the other interesting thing to think about in this context is we also made a decision after the Great Depression and even more so after World War II that we were going to create more equality, that we were going to flatten inequality so that you had the income of the top 20% growing, but growing less quickly than the bottom and the middle. And that was really a series of government decisions and political decisions that we made, and that we took steps to affirmatively create this vast American middle class that we've always been so proud of. But we did it with government. We did it, you know, in the New Deal with labor protections that led to unionization. We did it after the war with great education and housing programs. Even, you know, you could even count the interstate highway development. People were able to move out to suburbs. There were all these affirmative decisions that helped create this middle class and helped flatten inequality. And then in 1973, it's not that everything falls apart, but things begin to fall apart, and certainly that's when wages, especially for working-class people and working-class men, really start to flatten out. So at one point, we made a political set of decisions to flatten inequality. At another point, we made decisions to basically tolerate it or even encourage it. What were the forces that led to that change?
Well, I mean, let me emphasize what you said is absolutely right, and there's one other aspect of this that I think is very important. In the period that we were making our society more equal, say the decades after World War II, we were also growing much more rapidly than we were in the decade, say after 1980, when we were allowing this inequality to grow. And the magnitude of this growth in inequality since 1980 has really been amazing.
Yeah.
Just to give you one number, the fraction of the income that goes to the upper 1% doubled in 30 years from about 10%
right.
to 20%. The fraction going to the upper 0.1% tripled.
Right.
So it was a period of real, almost amazingly rapid increase in inequality. There were a large number of decisions that went into this change. Some of them have to do with changes in mores and in attitudes. Beginning of the Reagan administration, there was the breaking of the air traffic controller strike that was viewed as the beginning of the real weakening of the unions, which played up to that point an important role of trying to protect workers.
Right.
And the result of this, you say, a force that led wages to actually decline is seen most markedly. You look at the wages adjusted for inflation of a full-time male worker today is lower than it was in 1968, more than four decades ago.
Wow.
So that there's been growth in our economy, but for a lot of workers, things aren't going very well.
Right.
So that was one force. Another one was a change in social mores. In the United States, does not have the best of corporate governance laws. And the corporate governance laws, put it mildly, I say, corporate governance laws are the laws that say, for instance, how much of a share of the pie of the corporation's revenue that the CEO can take.
Right.
Do the shareholders have a say in the pay of their executives?
Right.
Well, we have very weak laws. It used to be that by custom, people felt a certain, you might say, sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
That the CEOs would only take maybe 20 or 30 times the pay of the average worker.
Right.
In Japan, the number is around 10 times. In Europe, it's around 20, 30 times. But then suddenly, beginning around 1980, those bounds got broken. And the CEOs discovered that they could take a larger and larger share of the corporate income, to the point where they were getting 100, 500 times the pay of the average worker. And then, of course, they would tell the workers, we have to lay you off and cut your pay because there's no money left over.
Right, right.
And there wasn't any money left over after they'd taken their share. There's no evidence that American CEOs were 10 or 100 times more productive than European CEOs, or
right.
that they...
Or than they had been.
Or than they had been. So there was no economic justification of this.
Right.
But they succeeded in doing that.
Well, some people, certain Republicans, and spend a lot of time complaining about the mores of poor people, and I wonder, sometimes reading your book, maybe we need a better class of rich people to solve some of these problems.
One of the things that I found, as I was writing it, so disturbing were the behavior, say, those in the financial sector, which you can only describe as almost moral depravity.
Yeah.
they preyed on the least financially sophisisticated. They get, 40 years after the passage of civil rights laws, they targeted Hispanics and Afro-Americans. And, this is not just my view. They wound up paying $100 million fines for
right.
this, and so it was systematic. And the result of it is sort of evidenced by, what some of the data that I cited in my book and some of the data that just came out yesterday.
Oh, God, yes. Well, please talk about the Fed data.
The Fed data that just came out yesterday show that the wealth of the average American had been so badly wiped out that we're back to the early 90s.
Right.
20 years of savings got wiped out. And one of the reasons for that was they targeted these really bad mortgages on the least financially sophisticated.
Right. Right. And and in the end, the banks got bailed out for that kind of behavior, and people lost their homes. So that, you know, the average American's net worth declined 40% in 3 years alone, from 2000 to 2010. I mean, that's an astonishing number.
Yeah, and you
number.
Talk about, you know, this kind of depravity in the rule of law. I have one chapter I talk about the rule of law. The rule of law is supposed to protect those who need protection, you know, not
right.
to protect the top, but to protect the average
right.
American. And yet our bankers in the foreclosure were signing affidavits saying that they had examined the records, this person owed the money. They were signing these affidavits to the court by the thousands.
Right.
When they had not examined
right.
The records, the effect of which was that they threw out many Americans, not just one, but many Americans who owed nothing.
Right.
Their defense was, well, most of the people we threw out of their homes did owe something. But that was like saying, you know, most of the people who get capital punishment,
they did something.
They
no,
did something,
they were bad
we know.
Guys.
Well, you know. But this is the standard of justice.
That's acceptable.
That was accepted. Not one of these guys has received any punishment.
Right.
Not one of them.
I want to ask you about your old boss, Bill Clinton, who is kind of a controversial figure, most popular living president in the last poll last week, but, you know, controversial even to Democrats. Did a lot of good things for the economy. During his presidency, income inequality did flatten a little bit.
We had
an improvement. He also signed Glass-Steagall and, you know, is often blamed for accelerating the, quote, financialization of the economy. And really what that means is that we did privilege the financial sector of the economy over other sorts of ways of making money. We did. We made we voted for them. We're, you know, citizens, made those decisions. How do you look back on what Bill Clinton, we'll be short with this, but
okay.
I couldn't resist asking, since he's in the news again, too.
Okay. Well, that was a particular issue where I fought Treasury.
I'm aware.
It was a battle. And while I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, it didn't happen. I don't think it was just because of me.
Right.
But the critical factor, if you really want to know what happened, was Citibank wanted to merge, bring in Travelers Insurance,
right.
merge. And some people called the repeal of Glass-Steagall the Citibank Relief Act or something like that. And the irony, of course, was the biggest bailout in the end went to Citibank.
Right.
You know, so there's a little irony in this. But we had some really intense debates over this. The reason we had passed Glass-Steagall back in the 30s was the conflicts of interest that had arisen during the Roaring 20s.
Right.
And when I had these debates with Rubin, he would say, well, don't worry about that. We'll create Chinese walls.
Chinese walls?
And I said, well, yes, Chinese walls, but you'll just walk over them. And that's, of course, what they did.
Yeah.
And I thought there were two other problems that really disturbed me. One is that the commercial banks are supposed to be take ordinary individuals' money, invest it prudently. The investment banks take upper income individuals' money and often take riskier positions.
Right.
But if you put the two together, I was afraid that the gambling mentality would dominate over the commercial, over the prudent
neighborhood banker mentality.
Exactly. And bankers that were focused on lending.
Right.
And that's what happened. So the banker, the culture of risk-taking, speculation, derivatives, CDSs, that dominated.
That's what grew.
And the problem was the kind of lending that goes to create jobs, to create new businesses, that got shunted aside. And the third thing that bothered me, the reason I opposed it, was I was worried that as you merge these institutions together, you got bigger and bigger banks.
Yes.
You got too big to fail banks. And the problem is not only did they get too big to fail, they got too big to be held accountable.
Right.
And that's why they didn't. Nobody has got, actually gotten. They've been forced to pay a fine, but there's been nobody who's been held individually accountable.
Right. Talk a little bit, though, about the price of inequality as we're coming to grapple with it. It is something, I think that the great thing in the last year is that I think there is more awareness of the data, of the phenomenon. Occasionally bizarre people will defend it, but for the most part, Americans are kind of scandalized by it. Begin to add up the price of inequality and explain why it's bad for everyone.
Well, naturally, as an economist, I began the analysis focusing on the economic price.
Right.
And what I I concluded was that this inequality actually weakens our economy. And it is a very different view than some on the right who said, oh, yes, we know inequality is not a great thing, but the cost of getting rid of the inequality is very high.
Right.
And so there's a trade-off, and the kind of thing that a lot of standard textbooks say, you can get more equality with the price of lower growth. Well, what my analysis showed, and a lot of other people's, was that, in fact, it was just the opposite. We were giving up growth. We were giving up efficiency, particularly, one of the reasons, because of the way our inequality is created. If you have inequality created, as I described it, by market distortions, monopoly power, predatory lending, all these kinds of activities, which economists call rent-seeking, which is our attempts to getting a larger size of the pie, slice of the pie, rather than enlarging the size of the pie, what you're doing is you're not actually adding to the strength of the economy, you're actually subtracting from it.
So as in your example before, of predatory lending, which is then protected by bankruptcy law, that sort of rent seeking is just taking money out of somebody else's pockets rather than creating wealth.
And using up valuable resources. I mean, right. One of the things as a teacher that upset me so much is how many of our best students were going into those activities.
Yes.
Rather than into really creative activity of making new products or making, the innovations that transistor, the laser, computer, DNA, whatever. So that they really distorted our scarcest talent, our young people.
Right.
That's only one of the reasons that it weakens our economy. Another reason is it's not just an accident that the level of inequality reached a peak just before the Great Depression. Just like it reached a very high level just before the Great Recession.
Right.
And the IMF, which is not known to be exactly a leftist organization, as well as the UN Commission, both have pointed out that inequality leads to instability. Systematically, if you look across countries and you see these examples, and there's a good reason for it that if we have time, we can talk about. A third reason that inequality is very bad is that for a society to function, for an economy to function, you need a lot of investment in the common good, public investment. You need, you're talking before about roads that make a difference, education, technology, the internet.
Right.
So many things depend on public investment. The public commons. And countries with a lot of inequality can't get that common investment. And so you underinvest in the commons, and you get economies that underperform. And that's a direction in which the United States has been moving.
And we're really seeing that here. I have a question that is related, very much related to where we're going. Great analysis, but the economics is the easy part. How do you recommend that we go about changing the attitudes and the opinions that put us in this predicament?
Well, actually, there are two parts to this that I want to call attention to. As I said, the economics is shaped by the politics. One of the titles I was thinking of is sort of a paraphrase of Clinton's it's the economy stupid. In a way, it's the politics stupid. It's really the political process.
Yeah.
And just like the rules and regulations shape the economy, there are a set of rules and regulations that shape the politics. If you allow unbridled spending in campaigns, like Citizens United, if you have revolving doors, if you have lobbying, it helps shape the politics. And there are a whole set of other provisions, gerrymandering, all of which lead to a politics in which the upper 1%, or the top, and I'm using the term 1% as a very generic term,
right,
have undue influence. But for anybody who studied political science, there's a puzzle here, because we are supposed to have a democracy. And a democracy is supposed to be one person, one vote. And the standard theory in political science is that, therefore, the democracy should reflect the interest of the people in the middle. So there's a theory called the median voter theory that
right.
says that the level of spending should be such that half want more and half want less. So it's the person in the middle, and that's how you reach the compromise.
Right.
Okay. Well, if you look at the outcomes of American political process, no one can say they represent the middle. You know, the middle isn't interested in a tax law or doesn't support a tax law, I think, that says, or shouldn't support a tax law, that says speculators are going to be taxed at a much lower rate than those who work for a living.
Right.
That the upper 1% would pay an average tax rate of 15%. When a lot of people making much lower incomes are paying tax rates of 30, 35%.
Right.
So you say, how do we wind up in that kind of a politics where the outcome isn't reflecting the interests of the middle class? And there are two arguments I put forward in the book, and I discussed some others. One of them is that we've actually had a politics of disillusionment, as well as disenfranchisement, that because so many people have come to the view that no matter who they vote for, it's going to be
right.
The people at the top are going to run. It, you know, in the last election, 80% of the young people decided it was not worth voting. You know, it isn't democracy.
Right.
80% chose. You know, and their future is ahead. It depends very heavily on what kind of democracy
right.
we have. And they said, we've looked at what's happened, and we don't think it's going to make any difference which side we vote. I think they're wrong. But the consequence of this is it even gives more power to money, because then money is used to get out the vote.
On the other side.
To get out, because you're not getting a full representation of Americans. You're getting the people who feel fanatic on one side or the other. The second reason, though, has to do with, you might say persuasion. That's maybe a gentle term for it. The corporations discovered over the recent decades that they could sell Americans on almost anything. So take cigarettes as an example. The cigarette companies had a very successful campaign claiming that there was no credible scientific evidence that smoking caused cancer. They had in their own files the evidence. But the point was that it was a terribly successful campaign. Lasted, you know, for several decades, a lot of Americans bought the notion of what the cigarette companies were saying. There was no credible evidence.
Right.
Well, if you can sell toxic products like cigarettes... You can sell toxic ideas as well.
Right.
And so they have the tools, ideas in behavioral economics, ideas in psychology and marketing. They have the resources, and they have the incentives. And they've been able to do it.
Well, climate change just kind of jumps out as an example, like cigarettes, where they've got all the real information in their file drawers, but they're peddling junk science and managing. I forget the exact number, but many fewer Americans believe in man-made climate change than did even when we elected President Obama. Even in the last 3.5 years, the numbers have dropped.
That's right. And in that sense, we're totally different from the rest of the world.
Right.
The other advanced industrial countries have, you know, sort of believing science. And that sounds like a radical idea.
I don't know what they're thinking.
It's almost like socialism, I suppose. But I think that they've sold a lot of Americans on a bill of goods that what is in the interest of the top 1% or the people at the top is in their interest. And so you get these astounding results that most Americans are against, say, the estate tax.
Right.
When you don't pay the estate tax unless your income, your bequest for a married couple is over $10
million.
Now, the average American is nowhere near that. And if they had the reality of mobility, the probability that they are going to move from where they are into that...
All the way up.
Yeah, I wish they would.
Right.
But it's not going to happen.
And but when you call it the death tax, it sounds like it happens to all of us.
Yeah,
death
exactly.
And taxes. Oh, yeah. The death tax. We don't want that.
Yeah. So that's an example of how they've been able to use tools to really distort people's perception and in that way distort the democratic process.
Well, and... I guess I would ask again to President Clinton and President Obama to some extent, both parties allowed this to happen. I mean, there are ways that the Democrats resisted. There are ways that currently Democrats are fighting back. But this process happened under both Republican and Democratic presidents. And that's the thing that I can't really get my mind around, even though I lived through most of it as an adult, is how... Was it this? I mean, I get simplistic sometimes and think, well, it was the search for money. It was the financial arms race, and Wall Street had money, and so we're going to learn to love this growing industry and come to associate its growth. What's good for Wall Street is good for business, like General Motors used to be. Or
I think that played a role. It was a growth industry, in a sense.
Right.
It was a growing because they were taking more and more money from the bottom. But we in a sense, lost our way. You know, before the crisis, 40% of all profits, 40% of all corporate profits were garnered by the financial industry. And what's so striking about that number is the financial sector is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end.
Right.
It's supposed to make the rest of our economy more efficient, exposed to allocate capital, manage risk, make the whole economy work more efficiently.
Right.
Well, if for performing that service, they're getting so much income, 40%, you have to say, wow, they must have really been goosing the engine of our economic growth. But as Paul Volcker said, there was no evidence that any of these financial innovations led to faster growth in any way. And the only innovation that he said made any difference was the ATM machine. And the mistake he made was that was a British innovation, not an American innovation.
Oops.
So the point is you can't, and you can look at the data, you cannot see any relationship between all this financial activity and faster growth. As I mentioned before, growth in the period when banks did what they were supposed to do in the
right.
Decades after Glass-Steagall and the decades after World War II was much more rapid than in the era of deregulation.
There are several. Here in Silicon Valley, even, there are several questions about whether and how we can bring back manufacturing, what's happened to our manufacturing sector. One person asks, in the last 20 years, it's obviously declined. How much would you say has been due to automation versus offshoring and globalization? What would you be able to assign proportions to each thing?
Well, let me just make a couple comments. First, globalization is an example where how you specify the rules of the game can have a very big effect on inequality and how our economy functions. If you have tax laws, for instance, such as the ones we have, which say that if you keep your money abroad, you don't have to pay taxes. You encourage investment abroad. So we have a tax law that actually tells American companies, don't invest in America, invest abroad. So obviously that's a mistake. I mean, for many, but of course the corporations do not want to change that because they like avoiding taxes. I understand that. But still, they want to take advantage of all the science, of all the advances of America and the protection of our government.
Right.
They don't want to make their contributions.
Right.
There's a second aspect of the way we've managed globalization that I think it contributes in an important way to inequality, and that is it's very asymmetric. We allow free movement of goods, free movement of capital, but it's understandable, there's not a free movement of labor.
Right.
And what does that mean? It means that corporations can come to workers and they can say, look, if you don't accept lower wages, we're going to move to China or someplace else, and we can bring our goods back to the United States.
Right.
So either they accept the lower wages or they accept the loss of jobs. They're really put in a bind. And I sort of tell my students, think about it, a different set of rules. Think about what would happen if we said labor could move freely, but capital couldn't. You can imagine that. And then countries had to compete to get labor, skilled labor, say, to come live in their country.
Right.
You'd have to have good schools, clean air, a very different society than the one what we're having, where we're having a race to the bottom in terms of workers. So that's just another example of how our rules increase inequality and actually, I think, weaken our society. The main reason for the decline in manufacturing employment, not the size of manufacturing sector, but manufacturing employment, though, is not globalization. It's really our own success in productivity.
Right.
And even in China, the number of workers in manufacturing is going down. And the reason is they're getting more and more productive. They can produce more with fewer workers. But that raises a really important point for our future. We're going to have to restructure our economy.
Yeah.
Markets on their own tend not to do a very good job at that. And there's going to need to be an important role for government to help restructure our economy in terms of education, active labor market policies, providing the infrastructure that will enable our country to go from the 20th century manufacturing economy to the kind of economy, high-tech, service sector economy of the 21st century.
Well, I mean, it's interesting going back to, there are also several questions about, I think we focus on manufacturing because when we think about income inequality and we think about the people who are struggling the most, we have an economy now where people who didn't graduate from high school are in big trouble, and even high school graduates are in a lot of trouble. That's where you've really seen a lot of wage decline. And I think we all kind of go immediately to manufacturing, that sector that once employed those people and thanks to unions got them a decent working conditions, health and safety, as well as a decent family wage. That sector's going away. What are we going to do with these people? I don't mean it the way that came out, but, what are we going to do?
Let me just say, what we've been doing to save those manufacturing jobs is to convert them into poor jobs.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at the wages, say, in the automobile industry, it's about a third of what they used to be.
You were a skeptic of the, quote, bailout.
I was a skeptic of it. I think in the end it may have turned out to be okay.
Uh-huh.
But the point, my real point was we shouldn't be fixed on the economy of the past.
Right.
We need really to be thinking about how we are going to transform our economy. And that part of the thing is we're going to have to invest more, as I said, in research, more in education. We ought to be hiring more teachers.
Right.
That's one of the areas.
Not Mitt Romney says, no, we don't.
He says, we don't need more teachers, more firemen, more policemen.
No.
I don't know where he wants them to work.
Right.
But there's so it seems to me that the you know it's very difficult for economists to predict where the economy is going to go. We know where we've been.
Right.
Who could have anticipated, you know, Google or some of the other industries of Silicon Valley 15 years ago?
So right.
You can't really predict that. But what you can say is we will have to change. And to do that change, we're going to need a more educated labor force.
I wonder, against this backdrop of difficulty and challenges as well as opportunities, how do you think America's changing demography is playing out? The fact that I think last week or last month, you know, the number of non-Latino white babies, however you want to describe people like me, I guess, was outnumbered by babies who are not white. And as you know, the years go by, the country will eventually. This is a very complicated equation, I think, because we've always found ways to redefine whiteness. So maybe we'll redefine it again and include some people that we don't think of that way. I'm writing a book about that, but I won't go down that road with you now. But anyway, I'm just wondering how you think our diversity both complicates as well as possibly helps this transition.
I think, you know, historically our diversity has been a real source of the strength of the United States.
Right.
But what is also, you know, in terms of what we're talking about in the price of inequality, one of the sources of inequality in the United States is, quite frankly, discrimination.
Right.
Particularly at the bottom. It's still there, you know, and it's
sure.
still very present. So, in a way, as the fraction of the groups that are, say, Latino, the groups that might be discriminated against get larger, I think we need to be more and more worried that and it should be more and more of a commitment to do something about this discrimination. You know, and as I mentioned before, I was astounded that 40 years after we passed our civil rights legislation, America's major banks targeted Afro-American and Hispanics to discriminate in lending against them, to try to push really bad mortgages that were likely to explode beyond their ability. They targeted these people.
And specifically, Wells Fargo, I believe, was pushing subprime, these terrible products, on people who had the same score. They compared African-American families to white families with the same credit scores and the same incomes, and they were steered to these things that basically exploded with teaser rates
That's right.
That,
I mean, it's a little bit unconscionable.
It's a lot unconscionable. You know,
and as that part of our population grows, there's more opportunity for them to do that kind of exploitation. Obviously, they don't have a moral conscience to stop it, and that's where there's really a need for laws to take a more active enforcement action to stop it.
Do you think that President Obama has done enough to explain and defend the role of government in creating the middle class of the past and hopefully creating, strengthening, widening a middle and upper class of the future?
No.
Okay, next question.
Okay. No, he's given a couple good speeches. He gave a good speech in Kansas. He's given a couple good speeches, but I think there are a couple problems. I think he's been timid to raise some of these issues, lest he be accused of class warfare.
Right.
My response is a little bit like what Warren Buffett said in response to this discussion of class warfare. Warren Buffett said, yeah, there's been class warfare for a very long time, and our class has been winning.
Right.
And, you know, he's honest about it.
Right.
And he said it in a somewhat disapproving way. I mean, he said, you know, we really ought to be doing something
about
this. And President Obama has been very nervous raising these issues. I understand that when I was in the Clinton administration, one of the early tasks that I was assigned to was to try to ferret out what we call corporate welfare. All these special provisions in the tax code, hidden subsidies, the effect of which was to give a gift to corporations, not justified in terms of increasing economic efficiency, just, as I say, a gift to corporations.
Right.
I've talked about the financial industry, but the oil industry, the mining industry, the pharmaceutical companies, and, you know, the 2003 drug Medicare reform bill, the one sentence was put in that said the U.S. government could not negotiate with the drug companies, largest buyer could not negotiate, and it cost U.S. taxpayers an amount estimated about $500 billion over 10 years.
And similar language was put in the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare. I mean, they too promised not to mess around with pharmaceutical
with the drug companies. And it was the price
profits
they paid for getting their support. Well, those are huge. Those are huge giveaways. Well, I was given the task of trying to compile a list of the most important items of corporate welfare. It was before this concept had become well established and part of the political debate. And I remember a senior person in Treasury whose name I won't mention. who got furious over that. He said, "You're waging class warfare." I said, "No, I'm not waging class warfare. We're just trying to say, why are you subsidizing this corporation or that corporation, oil companies or mining companies? There's no justification for doing that. It's distorting our economy. I have nothing personally against these corporations, but this is just a waste of resources, and it's distorting our economy."
But even that was called class warfare.
That was called class warfare.
By a Democrat, I might
add. By a Democrat. Or at least I always called them closet Republicans. But they call themselves Democrats, and they give a lot of contributions to the Democratic Party.
Right, absolutely. I remember when President Obama raised the notion of maybe taxing corporate jets. You know, people went crazy. And I before poor Pat Buchanan was kicked off or left MSNBC, he turned it into a populist thing, and he was really good at that. Going back to the Nixon days, he was always out there for the working man. And he's like, think about the jobs that you're going to cost of those those guys working on those corporate jets. You're going to destroy that industry. That's class warfare. And I just had to marvel at his capacity to take something aimed at fat cats, claim that it was really aimed at workers, and win the debate, essentially.
That's right. And I mean, there are so many examples of that. And it goes back to what I said before of how you can shape public perceptions in ways that confuse people's own interests. An example that finally, after more than 30 years, we did do something about was the ethanol subsidy.
Yes. That's a victory.
Which was in billions of dollars. ADM convinced, this is the largest company that was engaged in producing it, managed to convince most corn farmers that the benefit of that was going to the corn farmers. And there are a lot of corn farmers out there, and they like the idea of more demand for corn. Well, in a global marketplace for corn, especially in the early years, the ethanol subsidy had no effect on the price of corn.
Right.
It was a global marketplace. Right. It increased the demand by 0.01%, no effect on price. But the corn farmers all thought they were the beneficiary. There was the only beneficiaries were the ethanol producers like ADM.
Right. Just a classic example. I'm going to mix things up here because we have a couple of questions about Europe for you. As if this isn't complicated enough, but one of our audience members asks, this week's economist suggests Europe's crisis could be solved in two steps. One, a bank union, kind of FDIC-like, and two, mutualization of the country's debts. Your thoughts on this?
I think that's right. Let me first, because we're talking about inequality here, try to mention one of the arguments that is wrong, that often gets raised in the context of the European crisis. A lot of people on the right say the European crisis shows that the European social model, the European welfare system doesn't work. And what it shows is that if you have try to have a single currency and you don't do it right, you're going to have trouble.
Right.
So it does show that you have to get details right. But the countries that are doing best in Europe right now all are committed to the European social model.
Right.
The Nordic countries are doing very well. Even Germany. Merkel, you know, I have a lot of disagreements with what she's doing. But the one thing that she's right is what was essential for the success of Germany, particularly in the aftermath of the 2008-09 crisis, was their social model, which even though their demand went way down, maintained employment and avoided
they encouraged keeping workers on and
it actually worked.
Right.
It actually worked. Now, the two things that are absolutely essential to make the common currency work are the two things that the economists, it's taken a long time for this to be finally grasped. Unfortunately, European leaders still don't grasp it. So let me talk about what they did on Sunday. Europe gave money to Spain to give money to the banks to bail them out, $125 billion. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
For a small country.
Right.
We spend even more than that, but we're bigger.
Right.
The problem is they haven't fixed the underlying problem, and their problems are really very deep. Because if you're a Spanish depositor, you can take your money very easily and put it in a German bank backed by the German government. If you have your money in a Spanish bank backed by the Spanish government, knowing that the Spanish government doesn't have the capability of backing you, you know that given all the bad debts, there is a significant risk and that you're going to lose.
Right.
And it's a one-sided bet. You're never going to get more back than you put in your bank. But so why not move your money out of the country? And so this was supposed to stop the movement of money out of the country. I don't think it's going to – it may arrest it for a few minutes, for a few days.
Right.
But it's not going to really solve the problem. And the irony is that just a few months ago, the European Central Bank did the other side of it. They gave more than $1 trillion of lending to the banks in order for the banks to bail out the governments. So they have this bootstrap. The governments bail out the banks, and the banks bail out the government. And somehow this voodoo economics, everybody's supposed to think that somehow this is going to work. And I just don't see it happening. And the only answers are the two suggested in that question.
Those are good answers. I mean, I think we're also seeing that austerity clearly hasn't worked. And, you have seen President Obama in the last month or so, more than that, but really energetically in the last month, preaching investment and at home as well as in Europe, and saying that this is the way to stave off, falling back into recession. That he is finally talking a little bit more like a Keynesian.
That's right. It's taken him a long time. And back in 2009, I remember meeting with him and said, "Look, the stimulus you gave was not big enough. Given the depth of the economic downturn, you're going to need to come back and get more." And, his economic advisors, many of whom had been involved in creating the crisis in the first place, weren't that enthusiastic.
Not mentioning names again,
were not that, they were trying to minimize the nature of the downturn and say, we've solved the problem.
You were somebody who was invited to a nice dinner but was not in the regular rotation coming to the meetings.
Right. Exactly. So the point is that no large economy has ever recovered from a downturn by austerity.
Right.
Europe won't do it. United States tried that austerity thing under President Hoover. It converted the stock market crash into the Great Depression. A lot of, you know, you mentioned before my book, Globalization and Discontent. One of the stories I tell there is the East Asian countries and Argentina, all of these countries tried that experiment involuntarily.
Right.
They were imposed upon them by the IMF. And again, what happened? It converted downturns into recessions, recessions into depressions. Europe tried it again. Greece, Spain tried austerity. What's happened? Spain is in a depression. It's the only way you can describe it. One out of two young people are unemployed, 25% unemployment. We're back in numbers like the Great Depression.
The Great Depression.
In the United States. No light at the end of this tunnel, because Europe says to Spain, you have to continue that austerity. As long as they continue that austerity, there is no way that they're going to be able to solve either their fiscal problems or their banking problems.
Right. Well, you in the Vanity Fair article I referenced, I believe that you were also writing about the Arab Spring and the discontent across the world. Really, but this was before Occupy Wall Street. That was leading a lot of young people in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Spain, the indignados, to really come to the streets, and that it was, yes, it was about democracy in certain places, but it was also about economic opportunity, that there wasn't any, that the generation was being shut out and stifled, and they were asking for help and, you know, gainful employment and a future. What do you see now in both in those uprisings and Occupy Wall Street and here that could possibly get us out of this?
Yeah, one of the interesting, just to mention, a short-run forecast, one of the questions I asked in that article was, how long would it be before it was only a few months later that it was there.
When will we have this, right?
Well, last year I had actually an interesting experience, because I did get a chance to go to Egypt, Tunisia, and I talked to the young people. I talked to the dignados in Retiro Park in Spain, and of course down in Wall Street, in Occupy Wall Street. And there's a common theme in all of these, which I would describe it threefold. The first, awareness that the markets weren't working right.
Right.
The basic law of economics, as we usually teach it, is demand equals supply. Demand for equal supply for labor means no unemployment.
Right.
And there are some economists, believe it or not, who believe even today that there's no such thing as unemployment. What they say is all these people are just enjoying leisure. And they say it with a straight face. And then you say, well, you know, usually when they're enjoying leisure, aren't they happy? And they say, well,
rather
that's
than indignata.
Yeah, exactly. You say, well, that's a problem for psychiatry, not for economics. Some of my colleagues in the economics profession are a little peculiar. We obviously have a problem with unemployment. We have a problem where we have a society, a country, and a global economy where we have vast unmet needs, problems of retrofitting for global warming, development, poverty, and large underutilized resources. That's evidence that the market isn't working the way it's supposed to.
Right.
The second problem, a lot of them, I think, had hoped originally, particularly in the democracies like Spain, that somehow politics would correct the market failures. But they didn't.
Right.
And, you know, at Occupy Wall Street, that was really one of the themes. They thought that they would do something about the financial sector, and they did a little bit, but clearly not enough. And the third thing that was very common is a sense of unfairness. You know, in Tunisia, for instance, there was a lot of people upset about the high unemployment, but probably even more important than that was the fact that those who were getting jobs were not those who were doing the best in school. It was those who were connected, particularly at the top.
Right.
So when somebody poor did well in school, he didn't get a job. Somebody at the top didn't do very well in school, he got a job. And that got real anger about that sense of inequity. And those three things are, I think, common in all these protest movements. So far, I think the message hasn't really gotten through. And one other aspect of protest, I think one ought to realize, protest movements are not a context where you solve problems.
Right.
You know, it's not legislation. It's
no.
Not, they're a what they're saying is, our society, here are some problems that we really ought to be dealt with. And they're asking our leaders to do something about it and trying to motivate the political process to do something about it.
You seem to have a moment in the book, and obviously you were writing when it was relatively early in the Occupy Wall Street moment, of optimism. How would you describe yourself now?
Well, my publisher says I'm supposed to be optimistic because people don't buy books if they're pessimistic. You know,
it's optimistic.
A few years ago, I wrote a book with Linda Billams called The $3 Trillion War.
Yes.
And it highlighted how expensive the war in Afghanistan and Iraq were. It highlighted something that most Americans still don't fully grasp, that close to one out of two of those coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are disabled.
Right.
And that we are going to be paying over the coming decades probably more than $1 trillion in disability and health care for these returning veterans, as much as we paid while they were fighting.
Right.
But while the book made its point, and it did have a political impact and did change congressional practices on accounting, and so it did have its impact, the sales were not as good as it should have been.
Well, let me say here,
not that that's the main reason for writing a book, but let me try to give a note of optimism.
This is our last question. We're running out of time.
Okay, a note of optimism, and that is, our country's had this high level of inequality before, the Gilded Age. Roaring 20s, and each time we looked over the brink, other countries have had very high levels of inequality. Brazil had a very high
yeah.
level of inequality. It looked over the brink. And in the case of Brazil, they had two very good presidents, President Cardoso, who said it's very important that we not go that way.
Right.
There was a society came together, the 1% realized it was in their enlightened self-interest to make sure the country worked together.
And so we can get there ourselves.
We can get there. The Gilded Age was followed by the Progressive Era. The Roaring 20s was followed by the very important social legislation of the 30s.
The New Deal.
So I remain optimistic that we might be able to get there.
The book is optimistic. The book is optimistic and contains a lot of information about how we can get there. I'm sorry we were having to cut this short. This is a great discussion. I hope you enjoyed this evening's program, brought to you again by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We'd like to thank Joseph Stiglitz, and the book is The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. We'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Evening's program, brought to you again by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We'd like to thank Joseph Stiglitz, and the book is The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. We'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.